You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. You know, Don, it's sunny, but it's cold. And it's been that way for a long time. What's going on?
We just had two of the coldest mornings of the winter. It is January 22nd, 2025, as Lois and I are preparing this show for broadcast on January 23rd. And on the morning of January 21, it was 28 degrees at about 2 in the morning out by Vacaville, and my farm is not too far from there. And I'm sure we got to 28 degrees based on the injury I've seen on some of the plants out there. That was that morning. And then this morning, the 22nd, it was also 28, 29 degrees. Davis, my understanding, got to 30, 31 degrees. We've had a couple of very cold mornings, and it looks like we're going to continue to have frost right on through the next couple days until Friday night, when it's only going to get down to 40. We have had, as of January 22nd, 3 weeks of frost, visible frost, almost every single morning here in the on our farm. Not cold enough to do a lot of injury, but I was walking around looking at the leaves that were toasted on some of the plants that hadn't shown any damage so far. You know, those, I don't know if I mentioned, there are 10 or 12 bell pepper and sweet pepper plants that had been doing great. I was really pleasantly surprised. They're going right through the winter. I think they're gone now. This may have taken care of them. Our last measurable rainfall was back on January 3rd, and that was about a 16/1600ths of an inch. We had a similar little rainstorm right after Christmas, but really the last storm of any consequence was before Christmas. So at the rate we're going, we're almost a full month with basically no rainfall. Reservoirs are still in good shape here in California, so that's good news, but we are falling behind on rainfall.
So if it hasn't rained for a month, shouldn't we be turning on our sprinklers?
Well, I've been having that conversation, needless to say, with people almost every single day. It depends on what they would be watering. If you have planted anything last fall, midwinter, or recently with bare root fruit trees or roses or things like that, you definitely should water those. I've been watering fruit trees that we're putting in about once a week. A couple to a few gallons of water all at once is what they're needing. The soil isn't dry, but I'm just concerned that the broken up soil where I planted them is drying out more quickly than the soil around. And those bare root trees will be rooting out, as we talked about last week, at some point in the next few weeks. And that day, if that soil is dry, they just won't grow. So that's a common cause of failure for bare root plants. A gentleman talking about his lawn. If you walk across your lawn, not when it's covered with frost, but a little later in the morning, if you walk across your lawn and it doesn't spring back, I learned this technique 50 years ago. It's dry. It needs some irrigation. And so that would be another indicator that maybe your turf would benefit from one cycle of your irrigation system. Just turning it on and going, okay, it's spring. No, don't do that, because plants aren't using that much water right now. But we haven't had rain in 3-4 weeks, and shallower rooted plants would certainly benefit from one cycle. So this gentleman who checks with me every week, I say, go home, turn it on, one cycle, turn it off again. And then just wait and see what happens. Because if we get overcast, if we get a lot of fog in the morning, if we get even, you know, a light rainstorm, but enough to reduce water use by plants, then you shouldn't need to turn it back on again. Normally, we don't have to worry about that in January, but it was just a few years ago. We went the whole month without a rainstorm and people were beginning to irrigate. So we kind of have to use some judgment here in the valley right now. Things in containers, things in planters. We're watering our nursery every single day right now. All the container plants out there, we're checking on them, and the smaller ones are drying out. So things in containers need water. And here's the other thing. it isn't going to rot a plant if you water it in the winter, because remember, the pathogens that attack, that cause crown and root rot, are warm weather organisms. So even if you saturate the soil, you're not, you know, temporarily, you're not causing any risk of root or crown rot. I'm really concerned about shallower rooted things and about plants that have been recently installed. It's always stated that fall or winter is the best time to plant natives, for example. Well, it also is when it would rain on the natives after you plant them. So make it rain after you've planted them, and make it rain a couple more times as you get them through that first winter. Clear and sunny with days in the 50s, actually 63 degrees on Friday. And today, so it's going to be 63 degrees. Night temperatures in the low to mid 30s, down back to 34 and next Monday. So we're getting frost. I mentioned I was seeing some injury on plants here. Well, the plants I'm seeing injury on are things that I expected. I was mentioned Brugmansia, Angel's Trumpet, is a good example. Made it through, it was blooming just fine right up until yesterday morning when we got to 28 degrees and stayed there for a few hours. The blooms are completely destroyed and the leaves are very, very, very damaged. But that's happened before. This plant has gone down to 16 degrees in 1990 and came back from that, but the top looked terrible. So again, if you get frost damage on a plant, Lantana, Brugmansia, there's a lot of others that are in this category. We know they're going to come back from somewhere on the stem. Don't cut them back yet. This is really the important thing. Procrastination is an approved horticultural strategy when it comes to damage from cold, because you don't know whether we'll get more cold that'll do further damage. And those dead, burnt, frozen leaves are at least covering up the lower part of the plant and providing some degree of protection. And I'd be concerned if you were to cut back, say, if I were to go out and cut back my Brugmansia right now, all those open pruning points would be a point of potential further cold injury. So we don't prune back frost-damaged plants until we know we're out of any frost likelihood. And in fact, best is just wait until they start to grow. You can see where they're going to sprout from. Like Lantana is a good example, partway down the stem, all the way down to the ground. I guarantee it'll sprout from somewhere. They do. They always come back. But just wait and see and let the plant tell you when it's time to prune.
So I wanted to ask you about freezing and the physiology and the physics and all that. So I grew up in backwoods Michigan, Upper Peninsula up by Canada. And yeah, I did walk to school in 20 degrees. Yes, I did.
So did I, but I was in San Diego.
20 degrees below?
No. I never saw frost as a child.
That's what I thought. So if a human being is out in freezing temperature, your body reacts to protect you by bringing all the heat it can into the core of the person, you know, your central areas, your brain, that sort of thing. And your fingers and toes can get really cold. In fact, if you are out too long, you can get frostbite in
extremities. Yes.
Extremities. Yeah. But we have hearts and we have blood and we have ways of adjusting our bodies to try and keep warm. What does a plant do? A poor little plant sitting out there in the cold, and it's now 20 degrees above, not below. But what's it doing?
Well, the extremities are at risk on plants as well, but it really depends on where they evolved, obviously. You know, a plant that's a truly tropical plant that it never experiences anything below, say, 60 to 65 degrees, they'll be injured in the 40s, much less in freezing weather. But plants' metabolic pathways change. They synthesize different things in the plant as the temperatures get colder. And a gradual exposure to colder temperatures just redirects the protein synthesis pathways. They convert, they refer to it as converting, but what really is they synthesize more of one than of the other. Less starch, more sugar, more plant alcohols. Sugar and alcohol are natural antifreeze. In fact, that's within antifreeze. And so this is the reason that if you pull up a carrot in January and rinse it off and eat it, it will not only have crisper texture, it'll have sweeter flavor. There's more sugar in the root than if you have that same carrot in June. You can grow carrots in the warm season, but they won't be as flavorful. And that goes for potatoes, beets, all the root vegetables, all the things that produce starch. As it gets colder, there's more sugar, less starch, or just more sugar. So that's what we taste in either case. So there's a natural antifreeze. They change the metabolic pathway. But there are also things that plants do as they're growing that protect growth buds. And this is really important for some plants. They get a woody covering over the buds that are ready to sprout and grow at the base of a leaf or further down on the stem or all the way down at the ground. And plants do vary in that regard. If you've ever had the experience of cutting down, let's say, a juniper versus cutting down a privet, cut down the juniper to the ground, that's it, you're done. Project is over, you've killed the plant. Cut down a privet, you're just starting on a long relationship with that plant. So because the privet has all these growth buds down there, you've removed the hormones that were suppressing them, you've brought sunlight down by taking all the leaves away, all those buds that are down there, hidden just slightly underneath the bark. Now it might get a little bit of sunlight, especially the ones with which are still more or less on the surface. They'll grow as soon as the weather gets suitable. Many conifers, those buds, if there were any, are long gone. They've been so completely covered over with bark that they've withered away and they're not viable. And so the majority of conifers, this is an important thing to know, if you prune them, you're done. They're not going to come back. There is, of course, a very notable exception in California.
And that is?
The California coastal redwood. You cut that down, it resprouts right away. In fact, in the lumber industry, they know that. They can go through and clear out all the redwoods, cut them down, they'll resprout from the crown, and 40, 50 years later, they can go in and harvest again. You can't do that with a pine or a fir. You cut them down, they're done. You have to plant a new one. So it's important to know that there are some plants where you slowly lose those growth buds. Those plants typically have other ways of protecting themselves from cold. Notice the ones I mentioned, a lot of the conifers are from very cold regions. They have more bark that's protecting the important growing points way up high on the plant. Look at the candles that are getting ready to push out on a pine tree. Before they push out, they're covered with a waxy material. And they're down in the needles, they're way down inside there. So even in a very cold climate, they are protected from the cold and the desiccation, which is a big factor, and they're ready to go, and something triggers them, typically temperature related, some other plants maybe day length related, but especially temperature, they'll finally push out and expand. But they are protected by waxy secretions, woody, corky stuff that covers them over, and their own leaves and needles, you know, covering them over. So plants have a variety of methods of adapting to cold, but the simplest at the cellular level is a change in the makeup of the juice in the cell to something that is a natural antifreeze. Long answer to a short question.
Well,
okay, we have...
You talked about buds being hidden and all that sort of stuff. That wouldn't be the kind of buds that you would cut off and try to bud onto another tree, would
like
they?
Like a fruit tree? Well, hypothetically you could, but generally speaking, people who are budding or grafting will take wood that's newer, that's higher up on the plant. First of all, the buds are more exposed and easier to excise and work with. So usually you're using smaller, newer growth, newer wood on the tree than something that's way down at the in the main trunk. In theory, you could, at least. So that brings us to our PSA.
The Sacramento chapter of the California Rare Fruit Growers. Now we're talking about fruit, not pines at this point. The annual Scion Exchange is going to be happening. So in 2025, it's scheduled for February 23rd, and it will be at La Sierra Community Center over in Carmichael. And the California Rare Fruit Growers, CRFG, have a website, crfg.org, and that talks about all of them all over. I mean, this is just the Sacramento chapter that we're announcing. But at 10 a.m., there is a Scion Exchange for members. And then from 11 to 1, it's open to the public. So feel free to come on in. There is an entrance fee, and then people will be bringing scions for you to exchange with them. More to the point, there will be people there showing you what grafting is, talking about how to do this, all sorts of things. So come have fun.
And these happen every year. And there are, again, wherever you're listening in the state of California, CRFG has a chapter, and some are more active than others, but many of them are on various of the well-known social media sites. So you can find them there as well. CRFG, great folks. For a long time, they were our basic resource. Other than the Sunset Western Garden book, they had these one-sheet handouts that I had a stack of at my nursery. Someone walks in and asks about a papaya. Is there a papaya that grows here? I was No, except pull out the sheet. Here's one that apparently is hardy because they would know all about that. There's a macadamia nut that grows in Northern California. Yes, you can grow certain guavas in California, not because hundreds of people are doing it, but because these folks share their experiences and they have some of the best resources available. And those, you can still find those on their website, CRFG. I want to mention a couple of new programs here at KDRT because we've got two new programmers. And all I've got to do is find that now. Here we go. Mapping healthcare. Dr. Ulfat Shaikh is a pediatrician and professor at UC Davis. This radio show and podcast, A Medic with a Map, that's her, explores ways in which people around the globe make the world of healthcare better and what we can learn from them. UC Davis pediatrician, medical educator, and researcher who leads local, national, and international healthcare improvement efforts to help people access high-quality healthcare and stay healthy. Past episodes are archived, as all of the non-music shows at KDRT are archived forever. You can find Mapping Healthcare on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and you can listen to it live Friday, 5:30 to 6 p.m. Right after Next Gen Talks, which is a youth-driven program that offers a fresh perspective on local politics, featuring interviews with city officials and community leaders, hosted by Jasmine Garcia, high school junior with extensive experience in local government. The program highlights issues that matter most to young people, public safety, housing, education, by focusing on local actions that shape the future for youth. Next Gen Talks aims to bridge the gap between young citizens and their city leaders, fostering a more engaged and informed community. That's 5 to 5:30, and the other one is 5:30 to 6 on Friday afternoon, right here, two new programs at KDRT.
And if you would like to have your own show, you can suggest what you would like to do, submit an application, and hey, maybe you'll be the next one coming on. Info@kdrt.org is the communication center here. And so just write there and say, hey, I want to help. Or maybe you want to volunteer to be, I don't know, an engineer for somebody who isn't really good at that and would love to.
do you know someone in that category?
You know, there do exist people who have a great deal to say, but aren't really good with the technology. And so, hey, sharing your skills is always wonderful. KDRT.org is the website. Info@kdrt.org is the email. Don, I wanted to talk to you about this little note I got. It says that you had someone named Zandra, who is from Bend, Oregon, and came in.
Yeah, I just want to send a shout out and say hi to a podcast listener from Bend who was visiting family or friends in the area and decided to stop by my nursery. I always love it when people do this. A podcast listener, we chatted about the differences in gardening between Bend, Oregon and Davis, California, which are fairly significant. Yeah, always great to see you. Thank you for stopping by and saying hi. And she said, say hi to Lois. Hi, Lois.
Hi.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you don't get a chance to come to Davis and stop by, but you want to communicate with us, you can always send us messages. You can ask us questions. You can brag about what's happening. You can commiserate with something you've heard about on the show. And where would they send their messages, Don?
DavisGardenShow@gmail.com. And I would mention that much of the country is under major freeze as we're having this show. We were whining about 28 degrees here. My kid lives in New York. I have a friend in Ann Arbor, Michigan. We got nothing to complain about here in Northern California. Okay.
So I wanted to tell people about an article that Don has written for the Davis Enterprise. And most of his articles, now the Davis Enterprise is our local Davis paper, and Don's been writing for years there. Once it's been in the Enterprise for a while, he'll usually put it up on his website. So if you want to read old articles, where do they go, Don?
Redwoodbarn.com.
Great. Okay, so this new article, well, the first thing I saw right away was a picture. And it's a nice picture. It's got a bunch of apricots and, you know, some are orange and some are green and stuff like that. But it was the caption that really got my attention.
Yeah.
It says Blenheim, B-L-E-N-H-E-I-M. Blenheim apricots, quote, ripen from the inside out, quote, according to produce experts. So they are bright gold when you pick them. There are prettier apricots out there, but none with a distinctive flavor of Blenheim. They are also marketed as Royal or Royal Blenheim apricots.
So the article was about the Arc of Taste, which is a cool project of Slow Food, an organization that's been around for a couple of decades at least, dedicated to, as the name suggests, appreciating food as opposed to fast food. And the USA division of Slow Food, this is a nonprofit. I mean, this is a member-driven organization. Slow Food USA started the Arc, like Noah's Ark of Taste, to try to highlight food crops. And we're talking about not just plants, all kinds of food crops that are grown all around the world that are perhaps at risk of extinction. They're just not in the commercial trade for one reason or another. They're falling out of favor, or they're just something that someone felt was merited being added to this list so that people would consider them as they're planting trees or raising food of any kind in their backyards. And it's regional. It's a fascinating database. I highly recommend you check it out. Food, Slow Food USA, the Arc of Taste. So I went through there, as I've done periodically, and found the ones that have been nominated and added to the Arc from Northern California. And the varieties that I chose to focus on in this article were Gravenstein apple, which is unique Sebastopol region apple here in Northern California, Blenheim apricot, which is the mainstay of the winters area apricot orchards for decades because they could harvest early and ship them back east on the then new refrigerated rail cars. Certain peach varieties that were once popular commercial varieties but have fallen out of the commercial trade, although they're still available. Fay Alberta, which is a variant of the well-known Alberta peach. Rio Oso Gem, outstanding late ripening peach, one of the best for this area, actually. And then I also mentioned the Suncrest peach, which was immortalized in the book Epitaph for a Peach by David Masumoto, writing about his grandfather's peach orchard and laments the loss of this particular variety from the orchard trade. This is a good example. That book, 2005, sparked an interest in this variety, the Suncrest peach. Dave Wilson Nursery, Ellie Cook Company, the two main providers of bare root fruit trees. Sure, well, you know, they got some budwood. They started propagating it again. So just promoting these old varieties sometimes causes a resurgence of interest. There are a couple of plums that I mentioned that were on the Arc of Taste. Inca, which is a beautiful golden yellow plum that Luther Burbank introduced in 1919. Self-fruitful, great flavor, firm texture, one of my favorites. Elephant Heart, which is a soft, sweet, super rich flavored plum that ripens a little bit later. And I was a little surprised to see a citrus on the Arc of Taste. But the one that they mentioned, or that was, you know, nominated and approved, I guess, is the Pixie Mandarin, which was introduced in the 1920s, but it was too small for the commercial trade, right? It didn't get big enough for people to buy, so it never became a commercial variety, except that 80 years later, a company here in California started growing mandarins, smaller fruited ones, and you've seen them in the grocery store, cuties and halos, which are very small fruited mandarins that are seedless and easy to peel. They took existing varieties, modified their cultivation practices, came up with three that make up those programs. Well, the Pixie's been around for 100 years, and it's out there. I sell them. I sell one or two a year. I don't sell very many. Well, the Pixie Mandarin, easy to peel, seedless, very sweet, ripens in late winter, holds on the tree with good quality, getting sweeter, although less acidic, into the summer. So you have a, you know, great backyard variety that I think is going to come back into popularity because people now will accept or even prefer smaller fruited citrus. So that's another one that's in the Arc of Taste. More about the those particular varieties in the article, which if you have a subscription, you can go to the Davis Enterprise site. They also post a lot of these articles on Facebook. So if you happen to follow them there, you'll often find it there. And at some point, it will also be available at redwoodbarn.com.
I want to get back to this picture of the Blenheim apricots, yeah, because some of them are greenish. And are those ripe?
The phrase ripen from the inside out means it's getting sweeter before it's turned bright orange or gold. And the reason Blenheim fell out of the trade is that newer varieties were introduced which turn color before they ripen, which from a farmer's standpoint is great, right? They can actually pick them while they're still firm. They look ripe. They send them to market. And hopefully in that, let's say 5, 6, 7 days that it takes to get to your grocery store or the produce stand, they soften enough and they sweeten up enough for you to enjoy them. My experience with those, is they're terrible. Uniformly, they're bland. You're lucky if they're sweet enough to really consider it an apricot. I have never had a good apricot purchase at the grocery store personally. There is a produce stand near us off Pedrick Road here in the Dixon area that sells Blenheim during their period, their ripening period, which here is late May into early June. And they put up a little sign over them that tells you that these are ripe, even though they don't look golden orange yellow. They're not as colorful as those other apricots. If you let them get to that color, you're going to want to process them somehow because they're so soft at that point that many people find the texture unappealing when they're fully gold ripe. To me, they're overripe. But if you grow them yourself and you learn that when they just have the green shoulders, but they're starting to turn yellow, they're already ripening on the inside. They're already as sweet as they're going to be. And you can let them sit for a couple of days, but they don't have a long shelf life and they don't turn that bright, vivid orange color that the apricots at Costco or Safeway have. They're a lot better. They're worth it, let me tell you. So the Blenheim was the foundation of the apricot industry here in the Northern California area. They started planting orchards in the Vacaville Winters area in the mid to late 1800s. The railroad came through, refrigerated rail cars came into existence. They could ship those fruit back east and make a fortune on them. And many farmers did, in fact, do that. But a big advantage of that early ripening of the apricots, the Blenheim apricot here, is that we beat the heat. When you have a soft fruit that you have to wait till it's almost ripe, almost soft to pick, if we have a heat wave and an apricot is getting close to ripe, remember they ripen from the inside out, they'll kind of ferment around the pit as they're pulling away from the pit and becoming freestone. You'll get an off flavor. They actually do taste like they're fermenting a bit, even though they looked perfectly good. And a lot of people have had the experience of biting into an apricot that looked ripe after we've had a period in 100 plus degrees and have an off flavor to them. Blenheim almost never does that because you're harvesting them first week of June. So we very rarely have a heat wave of that degree that early in the season. Later, apricots are really not a good plan in the Sacramento Valley. You may be looking in the bare root bins at your local nursery and seeing Moor Park or Tilton or some of the much later ripening ones. There's even one that ripens almost in the fall. Much higher likelihood of that fruit being damaged by high temperatures before you ever get to the point of harvesting it. So I personally recommend an earlier fruiting one. Why would you plant any other apricot when you can grow Blenheim? It does so well here. So,
okay, I have in front of me, this is from Don, about the easiest fruit trees to grow to get fruit all year round. Now, you may remember, if you've listened to the show before, that on his website, Don has a chart with all sorts of things ripening. But this is the simplified version, just saying what you can get to get for January all the way into December.
Yes.
Let's go through this a little bit. The first three are types of mandarins. We have the satsumas that ripen in December and January, the clementines that ripen in January through March, and then there's some hybrids that go all the way into June.
Yeah, so mandarins, I just happen to think, are among the easiest citrus to grow. You really don't have to prune them that much. They're generally not as vigorous as other citrus. Satsuma mandarins can be kept like a large shrub, so that's a big advantage because you have to cut them when you harvest them. You can't pull them or the peel will tear. Important to keep them down small enough that you can cut them off as you harvest them. And they start ripening uphill a bit in November. Here in the valley, December and January, that's your peak period for the Satsuma mandarins, Owari Satsuma being the best known. There is an earlier one, Okitsuwasi, which I'm selling and growing, and there are some that ripen a little bit later. But that's really the holidays and into January is your peak period. Only issue with Satsumas, they are easy to peel. They have a slightly puffy skin, puffy peel. And as soon as it starts to detach from the fruit, they're vulnerable to winter weather damage. So if we have a hailstorm, for example, you know, just a normal hailstorm that makes little blemishes in the peel, rot will get in very quickly. So you've got to harvest them fairly quickly. It's a shorter ripening window, about 6 to 8 weeks. That's the Satsumas. That's the first. Then you have the clementines, which are the core of the cuties program, what you're seeing in the grocery stores. Easy to peel, but a tighter skin and a firmer skin that resists the weather better and a nice bright orange color. Our experience when we have them side by side, as we do right now at our nursery, I'm picking and bringing them in. If you're up at the counter, you'll see both Satsumas and Clementines in this period of overlap in their ripening. The Satsumas are richer flavored. The Clementines are firmer textured and sweeter. And so some people prefer the one and some people prefer the other. The clementines are incredibly popular with kids, and that Cuties program has been an amazing way of getting citrus out for like a whole nother market. But that's January, February, March, typically for the clementines. And then those hybrids, mostly from the University of California at Riverside, Shasta Gold, Yosemite Gold, Tahoe Gold, and especially Gold Nugget, start ripening mid to late winter into the spring. And in the case of Gold Nugget, they're really at their peak in April, and they hold just fine on the tree into the midsummer. So you can actually pick those as late as, I mean, I picked a Gold Nugget on a tree in September, and it was great. I would never tell you that a mandarin is going to be good in September, but this one was. So you can stretch your season that way. So that's the mandarins.
Okay, so the next one, which is the last of the citrus, is the oranges. And those, again, go January through March. Washington Naval Orange is the one.
Yeah, that's the classic Naval Orange that everybody knows. The original tree that they're all grown from is down in Riverside. It has its own little park. It's 100 plus years old and still there. It was a naturally occurring seedless Naval Orange that was brought into California and is now the parent of all of the Naval Oranges that are Washington Naval Oranges that are propagated. There are other varieties that are out there, but basically Naval Oranges are January, February, March ripening. You can pick one off the tree April or May. It'll be sweet, but it won't have the acidity that gives you the complexity of flavor that you're after. Naval Oranges are easy to grow, but they're more like a tree than a mandarin. You can prune them down for size control, but they're naturally bigger varieties of citrus. That gets you through March or April.
So the next section, those first four were citrus, the rest are not citrus. The next one is mini peaches and nectarines, and it's got Nectar Z as the particular one for mid-June to early July.
Yeah, I mentioned that one because it's one of the earliest to ripen. These are what were originally called genetic dwarf peaches and nectarines that came on the market 50, 60 years ago. The first of them were interesting novelties, pretty flowers, grew like a shrub. It's a naturally occurring mutation that obviously affected the hormone balance of the tree and shortens the internode distances. So they only grow 6 to 12 inches a year. If you've ever grown a peach tree, 3 to 5 feet a year is more typical, maybe 3 feet a year on a semi-dwarf rootstock, 6 inches to 12 inches a year. So I had a customer who had a dwarf nectarine for 10 years, and it got the height of her fence. The first ones on the market were mediocre fruit, but cool, interesting plant, just sort of a novelty. Dave Wilson Nursery, who introduces all the very output of the Floyd Zager breeder, does all the pluots and things like that. They've introduced several very good quality miniature peaches and nectarines, Honey Babe, Pix Z, Nectar Z, and so forth that ripen at different times. So while the first of them had fruit that I would just maybe give a 6 on a scale of 1 to 10, these new ones are up 7 or 8. They're very good quality fruit. And the thing about these is they're so easy to grow. You don't have to prune them at all. They'll get fence height in 10 years and maybe get 10 feet over 20 or 30 years. The only issue with them that I have found is that, like peaches and nectarines, they fruit a lot. There's a lot of fruit that sets. And if the fruit is touching, which it has a high likelihood of doing on a miniature peach or nectarine, anytime you have that contact point between two or three fruit, earwigs and other bugs are going to get in there. And so when you go to pick it, they'll be damaging the fruit. So I do still recommend that you thin the fruit on your miniature peaches and nectarines so they're not touching each other. Yes, they get leaf curl. Yes, like all other trees, the peaches and nectarines, they outgrow it. It's not really necessary to spray, but if you want to, it's a lot easier because they're just a bush. And you don't really have to prune them at all. Some people thin them a little bit. That's really not absolutely necessary. So you're growing a shrub that produces very good quality peaches and nectarines, not as high quality as O. Henry or Loringer, one of your more common backyard varieties, but they're very good. And you don't have to do anything. And if you're limited for space, you could stick one of these down at the end of your vegetable garden. Put a regular peach there. It's going to shade a significant percentage of the vegetable garden. This will just be a shrub. It'll be like having a rosemary bush there. So it's just giving up a little bit of your space to a bush that happens to produce peaches or nectarines. Very easy to grow early to midsummer ripening.
I know you said that this has really short internodes and that's why it stays small. Mm-hmm. If I were just to plant my favorite flavored peach tree, whatever that is, and then cut it really short and keep it really short, wouldn't it be just as good? I mean, I need to do more pruning, but
You'd have to do a lot of pruning. But that is what most people are doing with peaches and nectarines. I mean, the main purpose of pruning fruit trees, size control and managing the fruit load. Those are your two primary purposes, size control being one of them. But when you prune hard, a plant comes back with greater vigor. I mean, plants have what we call a panic response to hard pruning. It's like they're being browsed by a deer. They've developed an evolutionary response, which is regrow vigorously. So if you ever head back a peach, as you know, it sprouts out and grows very vigorously, and you have to do that again year after year after year. You can keep a peach tree under 10 feet without too much difficulty, depending on how you've trained it initially at the time you plant it and how hard you prune it, with late summer pruning for size control, winter pruning for structural management. But it's going to still have those 6 to 12 inch internode distances on the new growth. So you're going to have to work to keep it smaller. These things, you don't have to work at all to keep them smaller. They are naturally smaller plants, basically a big peach shrub.
Okay, so the sixth item here is mulberries. And I don't want to get too heavy into mulberries because I really don't think most people want to eat them.
They're quite delicious. It's interesting to watch someone eat a mulberry for the first time because they look like a big old plump blackberry, but they have no acidity. So that sounds good, right? Well, no, it's just sweet. They're mild, sweet, musky flavor. Some have pretty rich flavor, but it's just mostly sugar. However, they're unbelievably easy to grow. The biggest issue with some mulberries, white mulberry in particular, is that it reseeds like crazy. If you've ever planted a fruitless mulberry, that's the male. It's a dioecious tree. The female, if you happen to end up with one, it's going to be a 40 by 40 foot tree that produces mild flavored fruit and reseeds all over your neighborhood. So don't plant those. But most of the mulberry varieties you can purchase for fruit production are parthenocarpic. Word of the day means they produce fruit without pollination. They produce fruit that does not have seeds. So they're seedless, which is great. And that means they don't reseed all over your yard and makes them easier to eat in some ways as well. But you need to know a little bit more about mulberries. They produce heavily. The Morris nigra, the most popular Persian mulberry or black mulberry, very juicy. Breaks apart as you're pulling it off the tree. The juice runs down your hand and stays there for days, gets on your clothing, stays there for days, stains everything underneath it and all around it. Don't put this over a spa, patio, table, anything like that. They are a small, slow-growing tree. I have a Morris nigra that's 30 years old. It's about 12 by 12, so that's great. But the other thing about them is the birds will discover them. That's cool. I like that. That's one of my main purposes in planting a mulberry on my farm, to draw the scrub jays and mockingbirds and then the cedar waxwings and whatnot. But once they find them, you're not going to be wanting to pick much of that fruit because they really like them. They come in there and they spend all day in there eating and crapping all over the place. So you will probably at that point just consider it a way of feeding wildlife. There is an exception. You're going to have to look around for this or go to the Scion Exchange of the California Rare Fruit Growers, the Pakistan mulberry. The fruit are about 3 to 4 inches long. They look for all the world like a caterpillar. They are not as intensely flavored as Morris nigra, but they're very sweet and somewhat juicy, and they stay intact when you tug on them. In fact, they're very easy to harvest. You could even put a tarp on the ground, shake the tree. A whole bunch of them will fall down. They don't break when they do that. So you could pick them up and take them in and share them with your friends. They'll go, ooh, a caterpillar. And then they'll eat it and it'll be delicious. The Pakistan mulberries are a pretty cool tree, but they get about 30 by 30. So this is a big tree. The Morris nigra is a much smaller plant. Fun to grow, but maybe see if you can sample one before you plant one, because they're not to everybody's liking. They are, however, a great way to draw wildlife to the garden.
And you said that they ripen in early summer, but you have a long harvest.
Like figs, they continue to initiate fruit for several weeks. And so I can pick, if I choose to, off of my Morris nigra trees, the black mulberries for 6 or 8 weeks. There's some ripe, some just developing. So it's a very long harvest. The main thing would be, because of that, it's an ongoing increasing draw to the birds. So if you really want them for yourself, prune them shorter and net over them, or else you're just going to basically watch it turn into a bird festival. Nothing wrong with that, but.
Okay, the seventh one on the list are plums and pluots. And we have the Santa Rosa plum, which ripens in June or early July. And then most others, plums and pluots, ripen in late July into September. And yeah, we could have an entire discussion about all the different kinds of plums and pluots. But the key thing is Santa Rosa will be the stud bush for everybody.
That's what we call it. It's the stud plum. Most plums need cross-pollination. Most Japanese plums need cross-pollination. the ones introduced by Luther Burbank in particular. But Santa Rosa will pollinize all of them, and it will also pollinize almost all of the pluots that have been introduced in recent years. So if plums are really easy to grow, I really want to emphasize this, at least on the West Coast. I know you guys back east have plum curculio, and you have to spray all the time for that particular pest. We don't have that in the Western states. And so you just basically plant them, train them, prune them. Every year is good, but you don't absolutely have to do it every year. And fruit load management may be one of your main goals in pruning, because you can get several hundred fruit on a tree, as Lois can attest. Santa Rosa will pollinize the others, even though they ripen at different times, they bloom at the same time. So it will take care of that. If you had a Santa Rosa in June and you had a Satsuma in August, that'd be a great combination. There's a lot of ways you can stretch the season just by which ones you pick. Same thing with the pluots, very, very easy. And a few of them, Emerald Butte, Nubiana, you can pick over 4 or 5 weeks. In the case of Emerald Butte, you can pick them over almost 2 months. So some varieties will say that on the label, harvest over an extended period. And that's a big advantage in some cases. I mean, you have a plum, and that weekend you got to deal with all those plums. Some of these, you can go out and pick a sampling of fruit over several weeks. So that would be an advantage to many people. Some Japanese plums are self-fruitful. So you don't absolutely need to have a Santa Rosa for every variety that's out there. So when you're buying a plum or a pluot, but especially a pluot, check the label for the cross-pollination requirements. And if you only have room for one, you don't happen to want a Santa Rosa, Nubiana is self-fruitful, Emerald Butte is self-fruitful. So you can check the label for that.
And another word of the day, pluot, is a cross between a plum and an apricot.
Yes, and that's they're delicious. They're amazing. Most of them are later ripening, mostly August, but there is one that ripens early. A great combination. If you're just getting into pluots, Flavor Supreme and Dapple Dandy. Flavor Supreme and Dapple Dandy will cross-pollinize each other, so that's important. You don't even need the Santa Rosa for them. That particular pair works. Flavor Supreme, you're picking June. Dapple Dandy, late July and August. So right there, you've got summer's worth of pluots, and they are... As you guess, with the apricot parentage giving some of the sweetness and the plum giving the nice texture and the and this little more acidic fruit, it's an amazing flavor. And there are newer ones that have come on. So far, I haven't found any that I think are better than that combination. Flavor Supreme and Dapple Dandy.
So that first 7 items on the list has taken us from December and January all the way through September. Now, the next item is pomegranates, and that's going to get October, November for us.
Yeah, October, November, we have pomegranates, persimmons, and figs, and jujubes. I might as well mention those. So those are different, really different than the citrus and the stone fruits. Not everybody likes pomegranates, but there's many, many, many varieties out there. Almost every nursery sells a variety called Wonderful, and that's got a sort of an intermediate balance of tartness and sweetness. Pomegranate juice is tart. There's no getting around that. There is a variety called Sweet that is much milder flavored. Also, pomegranates are just ridiculously easy to grow. I mean, almost nothing goes wrong with them. They're heat tolerant, drought tolerant, very attractive, very pretty flowers in the late spring. The fruit itself is ornamental, even if you don't happen to eat it, and other things will if you don't. And it hangs on the tree pretty well. So even when they're still hanging on there in December, they're probably still good unless the tree rats have found them. October, November, figs likewise. Well, they get a small crop in the spring that we call the Breba crop. The late summer crop is the really, really good one. And figs do insanely well here in the Sacramento Valley. This is the kind of climate they absolutely love. And persimmons. I mean, persimmons are ornamental trees that happen to have big crops of edible fruit. In my opinion, they should be planted as much for their beauty as for the fruit. And they're just very, very easy to grow. In the case of the fuyu, the one that's still firm when you eat it, you can start picking them in late October, November. And the one that's used for cooking is hachia, the one that's soft, pulpy when you finally can eat it. And that one ripens in December. So I think that brings us back to the Satsuma mandarins.
And those are the 9 things, plus the couple extra that he added in there, that can give you easy fruit trees to grow, getting fruit all year round.
Talk to a lot of novice fruit growers at this time of year. It's the bare root season. A lot of people are thinking of fruit trees, and they'll come in, they'll say something like, what's the easiest fruit tree to grow? I keep kind of coming back to plums just because I kind of can guess what they have in mind. I mean, I could say persimmons, but not that many people like or eat that
or
many.
Figs are the easiest thing in the world to grow, yes. But I don't know how many people want to eat that many figs.
Yeah, I used to think they were all pretty much the same. Now I happen to be growing 10 varieties of figs on my farm now that I got from the USDA station out at near Winters. And the fig expert is a good customer of mine. So I've now learned the nuances of different fig varieties. I basically knew Black Mission and Brown Turkey. Those are the two figs that are grown everywhere in California. Black Mission is dry, but sweeter. Brown Turkey is softer and more for fresh eating. Those are okay. But boy, there's a lot of other figs out there. And in fact, there's, you know, figaholics groups on Facebook, people who get into all these nuances. People go to a lot of trouble in other parts of the world and parts of the country to grow figs, especially people from the Mediterranean or from Italy, where they, you know, it's part of their diet and they're living in upstate New York. And by gosh, they're going to grow a fig and make it work. Here, stick them in the ground. If it's a normal fig, give it a lot of room because they're a big tree, and plan to have more figs than you could possibly ever use. If you want a fig, and you don't want all that, you want a smaller tree, there are dwarf figs out there. Violette de Bordeaux has been around for 300 years. It's a very tight grower that makes a shrub. Black Jack is a dwarf variant of Black Mission. So it's like the Mission fig, but on a much more compact plant. Little Miss Figgy. The retailer, I'm really getting tired of this. I feel like I'm ordering at a McDonald's or something. Could I have a Little Miss Figgy fig, please? Yes, it's another dwarf fig. They're really easy to grow. You could do them in a container if you want, but more to the point, you could keep them as a shrub in your yard. More also to the point, you can prune figs as hard as you want. You'll still get plenty of fruit.
And for those of you who are listening and you had a volunteer fig grow in your yard, which is really common.
Yes.
Because the birds will, you know, spread that seed all over the place. Those figs are not probably going to give you edible fruit.
Right. This is important to know.
You want to plant a fig that is a named variety that you got from a store if you really want figs to eat.
There's been a fig industry in our region of California for decades, and those figs cross-pollinate and do have viable seeds, and those seedlings do come up. So fig is essentially almost an invasive plant in our region, as are almonds and walnuts and some of the other food crop trees that we grow. The fig you're growing in your backyard are Parthenocarpic. Here we use the same word twice in the same show. Set fruit without pollinizer. They didn't have to get the wasp that was carefully imported to pollinate the figs that are grown for commercial purposes. They had to go back to the Mediterranean to bring the wasp in that does the pollination. All of these varieties that we mentioned, Sierra and Ischia Black and Black Mission, Brown Turkey, they're all self-fruitful and they don't set seed. They're basically, though, as I say, Parthenocarpic. So they don't reseed in your yard. But if a seedling fig came up, it's a seedling from one of the commercial trees, very likely, and they will set what look like they're going to be figs. And a lot of times they just fall off without developing. And sometimes they develop and they have no flavor. So if you want a fig, buy a fig and plant a fig. The others are fine to grow as an ornamental tree. They're quite lovely, big tropical leaves, and everybody likes the bark is really attractive and so on. But if you want a fig for eating, you should buy a fig tree from a garden center.
Do you remember a few minutes ago when we were talking about cutting down a pine tree or a cypress tree and it doesn't resprout, but cutting down something else and it does resprout?
Yeah.
Figs, one of the something
else. Yes.
To protect them up from the roots, they will.
Yeah. And they're not here. This is important to know. They're not grafted. I'm not aware of anyone who sells figs that are on rootstock. So they're quite easy from cuttings. If your neighbor has a fig that's the best fig you've ever tasted and you really want to grow it right now, January, February, go get some dormant cuttings of that. I would probably start them in a pot just to, you know, control the soil drainage and all that kind of thing. We grow a lot of our own figs at our nursery from cuttings now that I have propagation stock for these, and we don't have to graft them. They don't need a root stock, and so they're on their own roots. So if it gets cut to the ground and resprouts, it's still what you planted. You cut a peach tree to the ground, it resprouts, you now have root stock. So figs are on their own roots, and they're very easy to grow.
So we have a question in our mailbag. This is from Jim, who lives in Woodland. Sorry to bother you two, but I have two questions. First, do you sell raspberry canes? And he's probably looking for Oregon 1030, whatever that is. Yeah. And then second, when is the best time to plant raspberry canes?
Yeah, so I get this question every year. Raspberries just don't do well in the valley. Now, I'm sure there's someone out there listening who goes, oh, no, I know someone who does really well with raspberries. Well, if you do, please have them send me the name of the variety so that I can try it. I have grown six or seven varieties of raspberries. None of them have fruited well. They grow fine. They grow here just like blackberries. They're less sprawly, runny. They don't run all over your yard. They increase by rhizomes, but they don't arch over and take over your whole backyard. And I've grown them successfully. They like plenty of water. They're not drought tolerant. And they flower at the time they're supposed to. And they start to set fruit. And as the fruit is developing, we almost always get up into the 90s and the fruit doesn't develop properly. I have yet to find a raspberry that does well in the valley for me or my customers. So I don't sell even the two that are mentioned for some reason in cooperative extension publications as being more heat tolerant, the Baba berry and the Oregon 1030. First of all, I haven't seen Oregon 1030 in the trade in 40 years. So maybe they could just remove that from the extension publications. That would be great. Nobody grows it. Baba berry is still out there. I grew it when it first came out. When it did set some fruit, they were dry and mealy and very unpalatable. This isn't raspberry country here in the Sacramento Valley. If you're listening on the coastal zones or up in Oregon, you know you can grow them just great. They just don't do well in the valley. It's too hot and dry here. The fruit doesn't develop properly. I should also mention, any of you listening anywhere, red-fruited raspberries were the first crop that the spotted-winged Drosophila was found on in California. They were found on the red raspberries in the Watsonville area, fully infesting the crop, and they spread along with onto the cherries, onto raspberries, everywhere that raspberries are grown. So one of the key things for commercial growers of cherries in Wisconsin and Michigan and places like that is they tell them get rid of all the raspberries nearby because they're going to become a source of this particular pest. So if you've had worms in your cherries, as you will, you're going to get worms in your red raspberries. And it's a lot of spraying to keep them out of the red raspberries. Thought you all might want to know that before you do a big planting of red raspberries. We do really well with blackberries, caneberries of Loganberry, Olaleberry, Boysenberry, Triple Crown. All of them do very, very well in the valley. The heat is not an issue for them. They're big plants. The biggest issue with those is keeping them from taking over your farm. I can speak from experience on this. Great wildlife habitat if you happen to be going for that, but it should be intentional. So those do very well here. You just have to figure out some way to train them up off the ground, but this is just not raspberry country. It's one thing I would love to grow that I just don't think is really suited here. So there is no particularly good time to plant them as far as that part of the question goes. Those who do well with them, I am told, lots of organic stuff, lots of mulch, lots of water. They pamper them. Give that a try if you're really, really bound and determined to grow raspberries. But in my opinion, if you're looking for a raspberry-flavored berry, look around. You may have to special order maybe for next winter the tayberry, which is a cross between a blackberry and a raspberry that happens to have the raspberry characteristic more than the blackberry characteristic and is okay with the heat. So the tayberry is a good option for people in hotter, drier climates that want that raspberry quality.
So you mentioned that you have blackberry thickets on your farm.
Yes, indeed.
How are your foxes doing?
They love the blackberry thickets. Yeah, so I'm happy to leave them. And the 35 turkeys that have settled in on my farm also like the blackberry overgrown brambles. I mean, these are great for wildlife. Yes, if you're out in the country and you're looking for something to create cover, blackberries do an excellent job, as do wild roses, grevilleas, and a variety of other rather spiny things, because that's what the wildlife like, is a place they can go in and hide where they can get away from whatever might be going after them.
So occasionally Don will send me a photo to ooh and ah over when we're on the show. And he did this again. And this one's just titled Camellia. And January 15th is the date of the photo. And this thing is covered, just covered in beautiful rosy pink flowers.
It's a variety called Freedom Bell. It's a very pretty one. It's a hybrid camellia. It's not really got the Japanese camellia, Japonica look of the big, heavily doubled flowers. These are kind of elegant, smaller flowers, and there's probably 300 or more blooms on this shrub right now. If I can think of it, I'll probably post this with the show description because I want to give one important bit of information about this. I just planted it like a regular shrub. This is on my farm. I've got nice soil, it's a nice loamy soil. The pH of my water is 8.1. So I have alkaline water with a lot of salts in it. But contrary to what we would have recommended at my nursery 40 years ago, turn a whole bunch of stuff in, add this sulfur, feed it all the time, do this, do that. I didn't do any of that because we know now that that's not really necessary. And so about 7 or 8 years ago, I planted this camellia just like a regular shrub. I loosened the soil in the area where it was going to go, dug a hole 2 to 3 feet across, planted it so that it was crowned up. That's real important. They're a little prone to crown rot, so you want excess water to drain away. Drip line goes through the area. I mulched it with some stuff in a bag, and for the next 7 or 8 years, I allowed the leaves of the sycamore tree above this camellia to pile up around it. I would rake them and mulch with the leaves. And I never took them away, except last year, we raked some of them out of there. And now I'm mulching it again. That's all I've done. I haven't given it any sulfur. I haven't done anything to mitigate the pH. I didn't specially amend the soil with an azalea camellia type food or anything like that, or planter mix of any kind. I put it right in our native soil. I've mulched it consistently since planting it, which I think is really the key with a lot of these things that we sell to you as, quote, acid-loving plants, end quote, camellias, azaleas, any of the others in that category. I think what they really need is a steadily breaking down organic material filtering into their fine network of roots. They do not have, when they're young, an extensive, a woody root. They have a lot of fine roots, as you'll find if you cultivate around them. So try not to cultivate around them, first of all. If you plant a ground cover, it should be something fairly shallow. I have Campanula porcharskiana, the Serbian bellflower, making a ground cover under this when there isn't too much mulch for it. And I just keep it mulched. And it's growing fine and blooming fine without any special attention. So once again, the old rule of amending your soil, we learned this from the Camellia Society when we opened, 50-50 compost to soil. No, it's a normal shrub, just like a rose bush is a normal shrub. You don't need special soil amendments, but they definitely benefit from mulch, and they are not particularly drought tolerant. So my experience with this camellia and others on my property has been, they don't need all that special stuff that we were all telling you a long time ago. You don't even really need to worry about the pH. You just need a good supply of steadily decomposing organic material for the root system. I just want people to understand that the advice on this has changed dramatically over many years. And at this point, we can back off from the old, you've got to amend the soil for this, you've got to treat for this, worry about the pH. All that's overstated. Proper planting, proper irrigation, and mulching will take care of most of those problems. I want a quick shout out, Zandra from Bend, Oregon, stopped by the nursery, said hi, podcast listener, and she said to say hello to Lois.
Well, thank you, Zandra. So our quote for today is from the Empress of Dirt. I have no idea who that is, but there's a website that she has. And one of her sayings is, gardening is cheaper than therapy until your spouse adds up the receipts.
We have a standard line at the register. Would you like a receipt, or do you not want any evidence? You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRTLP 95.7 in Davis, California.
On Wednesdays, 10 to noon, you can check out Sometimes Folk, where host Bill Wagman explores an eclectic range of music, including traditional folk of the British Isles in the U.S., contemporary singer-songwriters on both sides of the Atlantic, and American roots music and some of its lesser-known offshoots. Tune in for a great music mix. Sometimes Folk, Wednesdays at 10 a.m., replays during the week, so for the rebroadcast time, just check out the schedule guide.